You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at how guns are bought and sold in Chicago and what's being done to try to stop the flow of illegal firearms in the city. First, the late Lloyd Barbie may not be a household name, but he played a big role in Wisconsin history. A civil rights advocate, a lawyer, and a Wisconsin state legislator, Barbie's life and career spanned many of the key social and political struggles of the second half of the 20th century. And he was often right in the middle of those efforts. As a lawyer, he was instrumental in the court case that desegregated Milwaukee's public schools. Here's fellow Milwaukee activist Father Grappi describing Lloyd Barbie.
He was a brilliant man. People looked at him at that time perhaps as being too radical. I don't think he was. He was fighting a school board that was absolutely unbelievable. They not only wanted to try to integrate the school system. They gerrymandered. You can assess the attitude of the school board at that time in the segregated and intact busing. Can you imagine that, taking black students to an all-white school and not even allowing them to eat lunch at the school, putting them back in the buses, sending them back to the inner city school to eat lunch? Well, that's what he was fighting.
As a state representative, he championed a range of progressive causes, including access to abortion, reform of law enforcement and drug penalties, and the legalization of marijuana. Lloyd Barbie collected his writings, speeches, and other materials to document the issues of his time. A new book edited by his daughter, Daphne Barbie Wooten, brings that history together. It's titled Justice for All, Selected Writings of Lloyd A. Barbie. Daphne is in Wisconsin for a series of book events. Daphne, thanks for joining us here in the studio.
Thank you for having me.
Your father did a lot.
Yes, he did.
A lot of different realms. Where did his drive come from?
He was born in Memphis, Tennessee, the segregated South, and he was an activist. He was a youth member of the NAACP back in the 1920s. He was born in 1925, and the South was extremely segregated. They had separate but equal, but it wasn't equal in the school. So he went to all-black schools, and he also went to a historically black college, Limon College, and decided that he would be an attorney and fight for civil rights. That's where his drive was born, if you will. Our family originates from Mississippi and northern Mississippi, Shannon, and their family got out of Shannon and moved slightly north to Memphis. And then from Memphis, he went to Madison, and then Milwaukee, three M's.
And what led him to come to Wisconsin?
He has relatives. They had relatives in Beloit, Wisconsin, and they told him that it would be much better off if he went to college, an integrated college, or University of Wisconsin, Madison, for law school, and that he could stay with them for a while in Beloit, get acclimated to what was going on in Wisconsin. And he came here and was immediately discriminated against, which he writes about in his book, when his cousin Ambrose Gordon and he went to a restaurant in Beloit and were refused service on the basis of the color of their skin.
He came from a very segregated city, as you said. He ended up in Milwaukee, which was then one of the more segregated cities in the country and still is in many ways today. What was it like for him to find himself facing the same struggles in Milwaukee that he might have faced had he stayed in Tennessee?
Well, for one, he was an attorney at the time he moved to Milwaukee. He graduated from law school. He had already successfully sued in the city of Madison for its race discrimination in housing. And he decided then that he would go to Milwaukee and take up some more challenges. He was also not only an attorney, but a state representative. So he was able, through the legislative process, sponsor bills demanding that public schools teach black history, Native American history, demanding that the schools be more diverse, not only in their education process, but the teachers also, demanding that the African Americans not be shot by the police, which happened quite a bit in the 60s. So the Black Lives Matter movement is not a new movement. It started many moons ago. Emmett Till, for example, who was murdered in the South, and then continuing on through Milwaukee in 1967, when McKissick was shot by standing on the porch. He was African American man who was a junior in the University of Wisconsin system, and he was shot by the police twice. He didn't have a weapon. He was merely on his porch, and the police said, oh, that's justified homicide because it looked like he might do something to them. And that sparked the riots, much as it did when Rodney King was beaten, and they had the videotape of that, and the jury came back and said, oh, not guilty to the police officers. But at least in Rodney King, they brought indictments. In Milwaukee, they didn't bring indictments. They just said justifiable homicide. And so, yes, he went to Milwaukee and he enjoyed a good fight and, you know, tried his best to bring justice, which is in the book, Justice for All. He fought against the school board, which is extremely racist. As you know, in the South, during that time, it was de jure discrimination, meaning by law. You know, for before Brown versus Board of Education, it was legal for the South to separate people by races. And in the North, they may not have a law on the book, but they still did it. It's called de facto segregation. It was segregation by fact. And the school board would argue, well, we're not intentionally segregating. This is what people like. This is what people want. And that simply wasn't true because, as you stated, there was busing. There was busing, intact busing, where they would take African-American school children from predominantly black schools that needed repairs, which happened quite often, and take them to predominantly white schools, and wouldn't allow them to intermingle with the other students. They had to have separate lunch times. They had to have separate play times. They had to have separate teachers. So it was separate. And it was an in-your-face type of a separate because it wasn't hidden away in another school grounds. It was in the public schools. And they would do things such as the different type of silverware that they would give the children who were African-American versus that were non-African-American. The whole thing was right out of something you would expect in the South. And it happened here in Wisconsin in the North.
We're talking to Daphne Barbie Wooten, talking about a collection of her father's writings, Justice for All, Selected Writings of Lloyd A. Barbie. Now, this is mostly your father's writings, but you write in the introduction a little bit about what it was like growing up. You were out there in the protests and out there facing an incredibly angry response. Can you talk about some of what that was like?
Yes, I can. I remember marching with my father, with my two brothers, and we were of young age. I mean, I think I was 11. And we marched first against the Eagle Club. I remember marching the Eagles Club. Eagles Club was a private club in Milwaukee that only allowed white males to be members and would not allow African Americans in unless they were entertainers. And so we marched to desegregate the Eagle Club. We marched for fair housing across the South Street Bridge. And I recall people yelling and jeering at us, breaking beer bottles, jagged edge of the beer bottles, throwing it at children, calling us an N-word, yelling just as you may see in some of the movies of the South or the Pettus Bridge, the marches across the Pettus Bridge in Alabama. That happened over here in Milwaukee, too. And so these are some of the things that I experienced as a child, and I learned that you have to stand up for your rights, even in the face of ugliness, racism, sexism. You have to keep going forward and stand up for your rights, because eventually there was a fair housing bill. My father sponsored it, by the way, that did pass, as you know, he won the school board case, although it took him over 10 years to do so. So it just taught me a lot of standing up for your rights and keep on marching and keep vocalizing and protesting, which I understand now the University of Wisconsin is trying to eliminate students' ability to protest, which I think is a violation of due process rights. And in the book, I recall that he'd go to Oshkosh, University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh, because 12 students, African-American students, demanded that the University of Oshkosh teach black studies. And that was a radical idea, I guess, for the University of Oshkosh. And they had their list of what their demands were, and they were immediately arrested and expelled from the school at the University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. And my father represented them. And he brought forth a case which says you can't expel a student for protesting without a due process, right? Without a hearing, show us which rule was violated. Give us proof that it was violated. And you have to have a hearing before you can expel a student. So he did bring this case, and it's discussed in the book. So I hope those of you who are planning protests will read the book and know that you're not the first. You're probably not going to be the last, but you have to do what you have to do to bring in progressive change.
I want to listen to your father's voice a bit. Here he is sharing his thoughts on people of color and whites in the civil rights movement.
As Father Gruppy moved on further, the times caught up, even in a place like Milwaukee, in a state like Wisconsin, where if one is going to be a leader of changes that relate to race, that members of that race should be the leaders. Really, if there's going to be any leadership, you certainly wouldn't expect it from whites, because if whites were leading blacks, we wouldn't have had slavery. And certainly wouldn't have had to wait all the years we did after Reconstruction.
Now, going through what your father wrote here, what lessons do you see here for leadership in the civil rights efforts today?
Well, I see, unfortunately, a lot of the same problems that happened 40 years ago reoccurring. For example, my father was very much for birth control. And then in the book, he talks about how a lot of the other legislators first did not want to support birth control. And their reasoning was, if we give poor people birth control, then we won't have children or people to fight in our armies. That's pretty scary, because what it's saying is that we are keeping people poor to have babies and pregnant so that we can use them for the war machine. That's pretty clear. So now my understanding is that coming from this new regime, that they are saying we shouldn't have, women should not have birth control paid for by their employer's insurance company, but yet Viagra is paid for by the insurance company. It's pretty clear that that's based upon sex, and that that's sex discrimination. I'm sure there will be lawsuits if they haven't already been filed. But the point is, we should not go backwards. We fought so hard for progress. We should be moving forward. That shouldn't even be a debatable issue, but it is a debatable issue. So that's one example, is that you just got to keep forward and hope that as you continue to struggle and search for justice and fight for justice, that eventually it will stick.
We'll leave it there for now. Daphne, thanks so much for coming up to the studio today.
Oh, thank you for having me. Aloha.
That's civil rights attorney Daphne Barbie Wooten. She's the daughter of noted Wisconsin civil rights activist and state lawmaker Lloyd Barbie. She edited a book of his writings. It's called Justice for All, Selected Writings of Lloyd A. Barbie. You can find details about her book events around the state this week at wisconsinhistory.org/calendar. Coming up, we'll look at the illegal gun trade in Chicago, a city gripped by gun violence, and hear the stories of some of the individuals who got pulled into the web of gun sales. That's coming up here on Central Time.
Gun violence in Chicago has been one of the biggest issues facing the city in recent years. One of the root causes, experts believe, is the availability of guns.
Our next guest says it's not big trafficking rings supplying the weapons, but mostly small-time sellers. In a new piece, he tells the story of John Thomas, a Chicago resident who got caught up in illegal gun sales in the city, and how far authorities are willing to go to stop individuals like him. What's unclear, though, is whether or not the approach is working when it comes to cleaning up the city's gun problem.
Mick Dumke joins us now. He's a reporter for ProPublica Illinois, and his recent story there is called How Chicago Gets Its Guns. Mick, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
How big of a problem is the availability of guns in the city of Chicago?
Well, I'd say it's pretty significant. I don't think it's unique to Chicago, of course. I think Milwaukee and a lot of other cities across the country have had similar issues. But Chicago, I think in part because our former president from here is really in the spotlight. And, of course, among the largest cities in the country, Chicago has statistically the worst problem as well. But yeah, it's real. I mean, just this last weekend, I was walking to my neighborhood market and came across the scene of a shooting that had just happened a few minutes earlier. So it seems to be an epidemic here that just hasn't gone away despite years and years of efforts from people.
And your report gets at the question whether the guns that are used in some of the illegal shootings on the streets, whether it's big trafficking rings or whether it's a littler problem with individuals involved. And you seem to reveal that it's individuals. And your story follows John Thomas, who got caught up in a web of illegal gun deals. Can you give us some background on Thomas and how he got involved in this?
Yeah, I guess the first thing is, real quickly, to underscore the point you made, there are obviously some organizations that are going to bring in, or individuals who are going to bring in, you know, carloads of weapons. That does happen now and then. But by and large, what I found in talking to law enforcement, researchers, and just talking to a lot of guys on the street, is that it's usually small-time players, somebody who is exchanging one or two or three small numbers of weapons among their own social network. And Chicago police this year so far have seized more than 7,000 guns, some of them used in crimes, others that were just illegally possessed or transferred. And, you know, they find that these guns tend to be years old, so they bounce around for a long time on the street. So that makes it incredibly difficult to go back and find the original source of the weapons. John Thomas is a guy, we looked at his case very closely. He's a lifelong Chicagoan. Grew up in a neighborhood that has had its own issues with gang violence, but John really tried to steer clear of that for most of his life. He, you know, he'd been in some trouble, dealt weed and some other kind of small-time things along the way. But in 2014, he was really hurting for money, and he befriended an individual who approached him and said, "I can help you make some more money if you can help me track down some guns to buy." And he reluctantly kind of drawn in this. He resisted it for a while, then he decided he needed the money, and he went for it. And within a few weeks, the individual he was working with himself was busted by federal authorities and agreed to cooperate, and then continued to work with John to arrange more gun sales. So over the next several months, John was involved in a total of 23 gun transactions involving 77 guns that were, and then these transactions were all set up by the federal government.
And can you talk about that a little more, the role that informants play in all of this and how that happened to play out in John Thomas's story?
Well, this is the way that federal authorities often go after, go after lawbreakers, whether it's political corruption. They'll often find someone who is with a wire and offers bribes to elected officials. Unfortunately, in Chicago, we see quite a few of those cases as well. Terrorism, they do the same thing. They will try to lure in vulnerable young men into fictitious plots. And the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, the ATF, does the same thing when it comes to gun trafficking. So in this instance, I don't know why they looked at this particular individual. His name was Yusuf, but they had an informant who was working for them who first got this guy Yusuf involved by offering him a lot of money to sell them guns. And these were people working for the government the whole time. And then after Yusuf did this for a while and drew in this individual, John Thomas, we were talking about, they eventually confronted Yusuf and said, "Listen, you're in a lot of trouble. You can either help us out or stand on your own. But if you help us out, you know, we'll do what we can to go easier on you." And so, you know, he flipped and began working with the government and started wearing a recording device when he would meet up with John and these other individuals. And so they did this succession of gun deals and tried to kind of expand the net and get as many people as they could.
Now, one of the questions that you get in your piece is whether individuals like John Thomas would be engaged in selling firearms illegally if the ATF weren't involved and acting as sort of incentivizing these sales from behind the scenes.
Yeah, I think that is the central question of this case, and there are a lot like it. There certainly are illegal gun dealers in neighborhoods or people who, if that's not their, you know, their stated profession or something they're doing every single day, it's something they'll maybe do on the side or they'll do on an occasion. As we were talking about before, the market, the underground market for guns is very diffuse. There's a lot of people involved. So there's no doubt that there is a lot of gun exchange, gun dealing going on that is, you know, not licensed. They're getting in the hands of people who are have been in trouble before, who have criminal intent. So there's a big problem. But I think the issue with when you look at a case like John's is that there's no evidence that he was ever involved in dealing guns until the government got involved using taxpayer money to basically set up a sting and to set up these gun deals. John says he never touched them before, he was never involved, and there's no evidence of it. So, you know, the question is, it kind of comes back to, you know, if there's people out there who are making these deals, why aren't we busting them? Why are we setting something up to lure people in who are vulnerable? And then, you know, you're essentially creating a gun network and then dismantling it and calling it a day. Does that really get us anywhere? I think that's the real question here.
And Mick, is there any evidence out there that this approach that you just outlined from the ATF is effective? Does it get guns out of the wrong hands?
Well, you know, if we're looking anecdotally here or looking on the surface, it's hard to say whether it's effective. I mean, obviously, the gun violence is just continuing. It goes up some months, it goes down some months, but we've had a spike here, as I said, like Milwaukee and a lot of St. Louis and a lot of other Midwestern cities have had as well, the last couple of years in particular. The authorities really feel strongly that when they set up these stings like this and they take people down like John Thomas, that the word gets out on the street and that people are, it's a deterrent, and that people are wary, they're less likely to engage in gun dealing. But I just think there's scant evidence of that. I mean, on some level, you have to look at this as basic economics. There is a demand for guns, and someone is going to supply them. They're a legal product. We're not even talking about something like cocaine or heroin, which is illegal for virtually every single person who has it. Guns are a legal product, which has been determined by the Supreme Court and various federal and state laws that it's restricted only to a small group of people. So it's actually like the opposite of illegal narcotics. So they're just all over the place. And to say that there's a deterrent by luring people into a scheme that they weren't involved in the first place, we just don't have any hard evidence of that.
Mick, thanks a lot for talking.
Thank you. Thanks for your interest in the story.
That was Mick Dumke. He's a reporter for ProPublica Illinois, and his recent story is called How Chicago Gets Its Guns.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the ongoing political response to NFL anthem protests, including what Governor Walker had to say. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Amid an ongoing conversation about race, protests, and the National Football League, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is adding his voice to the mix. In a letter sent to NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell this week, the governor writes, quote, "It is time for players in the NFL to stop their protests during the anthem and move on from what has become a divisive political sideshow," end quote. In that same letter, the governor calls on NFL players to instead use their voices to take a stand on domestic violence.
This isn't the first time politics and sports have intersected, but the recent situation over the NFL anthem protests have elicited a debate unlike anything seen recently. So why has this story in particular touched such a nerve with so many people? And what does it say about the ability of athletes to bring about social change?
Douglas Hartman joins us now. He's a professor and the chair of sociology at the University of Minnesota. He's written several books about sports and culture. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here, Badger Gopher rivalries notwithstanding.
You're still welcome here in the Badger State.
So Thanks so much.
We just heard about that letter from Governor Scott Walker, Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. He wrote to the NFL. First, how unusual is it to have high-profile politicians like a sitting governor weigh in on the actions of players in professional sports leagues?
Well, it's actually not super unusual for political leaders to be involved with sports and talk about social issues, but they usually are not nearly so overt and explicit about it, and definitely try to avoid controversy and build solidarity rather than provoke it.
And Walker's comments came weeks after President Trump, during a rally, was talking about the same issue. Here's some of what he had to say about NFL players protesting during the national anthem.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a bitch off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
So very much not avoiding a controversial political statement there. What did you make of the president's reaction to the protests in the NFL?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty amazing. I mean, Trump's had a presidency of many unprecedented moments, and from a sport point of view, that was one of them, both being so overt and divisive and even profane in the context of talking about sports, because presidents talk about sports a lot, but they usually are doing it to try to build consensus and support. So he was really doing something quite different, as he is wont to do.
And this isn't the first time politics has made its way into sports, and you've written and spoken about a lot of past instances that we'll get into in a bit, but are we in unprecedented territory here with what's going on in the NFL?
In recent memory, yes, but in larger historical scope, no. African-American athletes and other supporters have used sport to promote racial advancement a number of times throughout our history, most kind of prominently or famously in the 1960s, but it hasn't happened recently. But in the last couple of years, there's been a definite uptick or even a new wave of athletic activism and awareness in sports.
Why do you think that is?
Well, that's a good question. It's always a little bit of a challenge to explain that. I think a big part of it is about the larger movements for social change around race, the concerns about police brutality, the emergence of Black Lives Matter, even just the reception that President Obama got. I think those things were really consciousness awakening for a lot of athletes who felt compelled to speak out, not only to support those issues, but because I think a number of them feel like otherwise their prominence as athletes is used to kind of support and sustain the status quo.
But we, as you say, we've gone years without athletes worrying about that, apparently, with athletes steering clear of controversy for a couple decades, really, in a lot of ways. You don't see anything. Is it the Black Lives Matter movement? Is it something happening outside of sports that's really driving them to end that two-decade, not quite silence, but more or less silence on political issues?
Yeah, and it's probably, you know, not just two decades, but three or four decades maybe. But, yeah, I think it's not so much what's happening in sport, though there's some of that. You know, like the overt racism of NBA owner Donald Sterling a few years ago, I think, was mobilizing for a lot of basketball players. But I think the larger forces are those gathering outside of support in society generally around issues of race. In a lot of ways, you know, a lot of the pressures in the world of sport are for athletes and everyone to not be political. We have pretty strong kind of beliefs and norms in our culture about the kind of the idea that we should keep sport and politics separate. So it really is a moment of real interest when that norm gets transformed.
Talking to Douglas Hartman, sociologist at the University of Minnesota, looking at the politics of political protest on the sporting field, especially in the NFL, not just in the NFL. Douglas, we've seen Colin Kaepernick really kick off this movement. He is not currently employed in professional sports. Coming into this, I mean, there is a pretty high price potentially to pay for athletes who'd made this decision to publicly protest, wasn't there?
Absolutely. I think that's part of why you didn't see protests in more recent decades, is the price that athlete activists, whether it's on racial issues or others, pay is extremely high. Not only kind of the potential of losing their jobs and kind of getting pushed out of their positions, but also for the most famous athletes, the loss of endorsement deals and commercial agreements, where a lot of them really make a lot of money. And I think that really they want to shy away from controversy. It's really amazing that so many athletes right now are willing to kind of put that on the shelf and put it at risk and take a stand on some of these social issues.
A lot of the controversy here seems to be on content versus form. The players say, hey, we're protesting, we're drawing attention to racial inequalities, police brutality, they say. People are looking at this and seeing the form of it, the protest during the national anthem, and saying, well, maybe protest somewhere else. You're disrespecting the flag, the nation, troops, veterans. What do you make of that conflict, that clash between those two perspectives?
Well, that's a great way to frame the question, content versus form, because I think a lot of the most recent discussions over the last couple of weeks have focused on the platform or the form and haven't engaged in the real substantive issues about racism and police brutality that some of the athletes want to focus on. I understand that a lot of Americans engage in sport because they don't want to be political. They want to be distracted from that or have kind of some entertainment on the side of it. Where that gets complicated for me is when race comes in, because the sporting arena has celebrated itself for many years, a century really, as being an arena for opportunity and advancement, for racial harmony, for meritocracy and fairness. So for a lot of these athletes, they don't see this as outside of sport. They see this as consistent, the racial concerns as consistent with some of the stands that sport has taken for many years on behalf of racial progress.
Does it make a difference when an athlete protests publicly over an issue like racial injustice?
Well, it definitely gets a lot of attention. And I think that if I don't know that it changes things in a material way or a policy way, but I think it's an example of athletes realizing that their voice is listened to, even if it's not agreed with, and standing up on that stage becomes a way for those concerns to be heard, especially by folks who might not otherwise want to hear it. It is, though, a controversial one, and it can provoke backlash and counter-response as well as support, and I think we're seeing an awful lot of that this fall, that it's really a backlash against the statements, whether you're debating form or content, the backlash against any kind of statement from the black athletes, that's really what comes to the fore. I think the amazing thing is that athletes continue to take that as it comes.
There's another argument about whether it hurts the sport, whether it drives away fans. Some people have pointed toward declines in viewership for the NFL since these protests started. But people are pointing toward declines in viewership for all sports, including a much bigger drop in viewership for NASCAR, which has very publicly said, we're not going to do these kind of flag protests. Does it hurt the sport? Does it hurt viewership when players are protesting?
Well, that's a really great question. It's one that I think a lot of my colleagues around the country who do sports scholarship are trying to figure out. It's hard to say that it's the politics or the protest that's driving that, because as you kind of allude to, the numbers, the ratings are down in a lot of arenas. And like for football, it's hard to separate the racial politics from the concerns about concussions on the one hand, or in college football, issues about players being paid or being able to unionize. So it's hard to say exactly what's driving that. I would say what's definitely at threat for sport is the idea that it has been a kind of sacred space above and beyond politics. And so those old separations or norms that distinguish between sport and politics, those are really under threat right now. I'm not sure exactly how those will hold, if those will hold, and what the larger implications are for American sports fans who've grown up with those ideas.
Douglas Hartman is with us from the University of Minnesota. He's a professor of sociology there. We're looking at the intersection of sports and politics after Governor Walker's recent letter to the NFL, which called on the league to end player protests during the national anthem. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the protests, the political response, including Governor Walker's letter? Can sports and politics exist independently of each other? Do you want to try to keep them separate, or is that impossible in today's day and age? Do you think athletes can or should be a catalyst for social change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation now about the increasingly blurry line between sports and politics, what's behind that, and whether or not it can lead to social change. Douglas Hartman is with us. He's a professor and chair of sociology at the University of Minnesota. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the ongoing protests in the NFL, reactions from President Trump and Governor Walker. Do you want to keep politics out of your sports? Do you think we can keep politics and sports separated? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Doug, I want to go back to some historical protests you referenced earlier. We're coming up, I think, on the 50-year anniversary of that Olympic protest where some American athletes gave the Black Power salute. Can you remind us what happened then and what the reaction was?
Yeah, you'll have to make sure I stay tight on this. I wrote a whole book on the subject.
Right.
But basically black athletes, Olympic athletes in the late 1960s, were worried that their participation in the Olympics would be used to support people who were against the civil rights movement, like to send a signal that everything was okay, that the success of black athletes reflected the openness of American society. They originally tried to have a boycott. That didn't take hold. But Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who were part of that movement, when they got on the victory stand, they offered the clenched fist salute in kind of recognition of the rights and challenges of black people in American culture. It's an iconic image in Olympic history as well as American history that really, I think, captures the tensions around race and sports and protest, not only in the United States, but in Olympic ceremony.
Can you talk about the reaction from the Olympic Committee and from the American public?
The Olympic Committee hated it because they saw it as bringing politics into this sacred space of sport. Americans in general, especially middle-class Americans, white Americans, tended to see them as villains, as traitors who kind of betrayed the country, who misused the trust of the American athletic establishment to make the U.S. look bad in front of the world. Interestingly, though, there was a minority of Americans, many African Americans, who actually were quite supportive of the protest because they saw it as true to a tradition of human rights, of social justice and racial progress, both in the Olympics and through sports. And another way to say that is they didn't think it was political or protest. They thought it was a gesture symbolic of sport's long racial, progressive racial legacy.
Let's bring in our callers now. Elaine is with us in Colfax. Elaine, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to remind people that, you know, the athletes that play at that high level, they often are college educated. Most of them have a degree. They care about their communities. And this was a beautiful display, a powerful, peaceful display of a kind of cry out from Colin Kaepernick from San Francisco 49ers originally to bring attention to this emergency in the culture of violence against young black men. And I just think that to disgrace this movement acting like it's some attack on the flag or attack on the military is just a diversion. And both Trump and Walker are using this disgracefully to distract people.
Thanks for the call, Elaine. Doug, what do you think about what she had to say?
Yeah, I think that's a familiar theme. A lot of scholars that study it would say the same kind of thing about the distraction. One other thing I'd mention, where she started talking about how educated and self-aware many athletes are, I think that's absolutely right. And part of what is surprising to a lot of Americans is how this it plays against the dumb jock stereotypes that we have of athletes. These are educated, articulate, deeply passionate individuals speaking out as citizens. And I think it's just hard for some Americans to kind of wrap that together with the stereotypes that they have about athletes.
Elaine, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Kathy on the line in Eau Claire. Kathy, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think, Kathy?
Well, I agree with Governor Walker. I think Trump is a little bit too outspoken sometimes. You know, I will say they maybe have a platform to be protesting under, but I just don't think they're doing it in the right arena or stage. The national anthem is in support of the people that fought for our country. I think it's a separate issue from police. I'm not saying they don't have anything to protest about. I'm just saying they're doing it under the wrong platform or stage.
Kathy, thanks for the call. And Doug, Kathy, obviously not alone. A lot of people may feel one way or another about the protests themselves and the cause of the protests, but that national anthem, they're worried about.
Absolutely. That goes back to your content and form question. I'd probably guess, I mean, I haven't done polls on this, that Kathy's opinion on this is probably a pretty dominant one in our culture. I know, like, my whole family, that's really what they think in terms of, in a lot of ways, the it's just not quite the right spot. I understand that. I think it's important to take that into consideration, but also to balance it against kind of the understanding that the athletes have about what they're trying to signal and say. And maybe the other point here is I think sometimes why we feel it's not the right place is because we think that there shouldn't be politics in the world of sports, but I think there's an awful lot of other people who also see the use of anthems and military flyovers and stuff as that's political too. And so it's kind of maybe the other question I might ask about this and challenge everybody to think about is what kinds of political displays or conversations are those that we're willing to celebrate and tolerate versus those that we don't think belong in the sporting arena at all.
Kathy, thanks for the call. We're talking about sports and political protests, the political reaction to the ongoing NFL protests. Doug Hartman is with us, chair of sociology at the University of Minnesota. He's written a lot about these issues. Back to your calls now. Roger is with us in Eau Claire. Roger, hi.
Hello, how are you doing today?
Good. What do you think about this?
Well, I just find it strange that they've taken this as the arena to do their platform. You have people that are coming to the event that are paying high dollars, in many cases, to buy the tickets to these events. And then you're sort of taking the stance where you're looking for a small minority of the population that is in that arena that might find this as favorable, where the larger population of the attendees find it to be discouraging and to really keep them from going to the games. I go to 4 or 5 major games a year for either baseball or the NFL, and I see a lot of people that are standing outside that are just tailgating right now and enjoying the actual party of the outdoors and not going into the games. So it just seems kind of strange that they're taking this as their method for trying to get their point across.
Roger, thanks for the call. So Doug, Roger's saying because of the method that they're using, their point he thinks isn't going to land with the intended audience.
Well, I think you might be right that it won't land. I guess there's two things that I think about in the kind of the, provoked by Roger's suggestions on that. One is I think that a lot of sports leaders, including owners and managers and many players, have long celebrated sport as an arena for racial progress and advancement. So a lot of these athletes don't think what they're doing would should be that controversial given the way that the sports leadership has often championed itself that way. But the other thing I think that's really important to remember for the athletes who are using this platform is their concern is that a lot of the folks who watch them play pay lots of money to watch them play and take a lot of entertainment from that they might take the wrong messages from that and see the success of black athletes as a statement on race in America more generally. And for a lot of black athletes, when you talk to them, that's part of why they feel compelled to do this, is to make sure that their athletic excellence isn't misconstrued as kind of saying that everything's okay with race relations in the United States. Again, this is something a lot of sports fans aren't very interested to engage with, but it's also something that the athletes, who are human beings like the rest of us, feel very strongly about in terms of their voice and the meaning of their performances in our culture.
Briefly, Doug, as we wrap up, this isn't just football. We've seen things go on in the basketball world as that season gets ready to start. Women's basketball, a long tradition of protests there. Women's soccer, we've seen some of that as well. Are we going to be talking about this just briefly for quite a while to come now?
Briefly? Absolutely. I think that's where we're headed with this, not just about race, but a whole lot of issues. And I think we're going to continue to have conversations about what's the right kind of politics, the right way to talk about politics in the context of the sporting world.
Doug, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
That's Douglas Hartman. He's a professor and chair of sociology at the University of Minnesota. He's written a lot of books about sports, culture, and politics. He's working on a new one as we speak.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's our weekly look at the latest in national politics, including the withdrawal of a nominee for the nation's top drug enforcement official and a threat to challenge Republican senators in primary elections.
We'll find out why a guest says there are two Wisconsins, and now more than ever, he sees a state divided along political and economic lines.
U.S. Democratic Representative Ron Kind joins the show to share his thoughts about tax reform, health care, and other national issues.
That and a look at some of the latest news of the day. It's all coming up tomorrow, right here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 8, it's the 50th anniversary of the Dow Chemical protests in Madison, which put Wisconsin at the center of national Vietnam War protests. Kate and her guests look back on the pivotal moment and what it meant for the Vietnam debate. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then a growing number of counties in Wisconsin are filing lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies over their role in the opioid crisis. We'll talk to a legal expert about what challenges those suits could face. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.